Welcome back to another episode of Weathering. Today we are talking about ensembles. Ensembles, the choir.
My first question is, what are ensembles?
Oh gosh, Marta, you know what an ensemble
Okay,
is.
but let me just say though, we have sort of a running joke about the words that we don't know that we always have to like Google or just like they don't mean anything to us. And for a long time, ensemble forecasts were the thing we would be like, yeah, ensemble forecasts, totally.
Well, I do think they are confusing when your like entry point is already probabilistic forecasts. So not to like pat ourselves on the back a little bit, but if you've got forecasts that already incorporate uncertainty and output in a distribution that captures reality well, traces are kind of a workaround for that. I mean, there's important differences, which we will get into, but it's like, why would you want this like spaghetti versus distribution of confidence? Uh-oh, we got into it.
Traces
What?
are also something that kind of mystify me, but I'm glad that you brought up probabilistic forecasts because I think that might be one of my like real first questions, which is the difference between ensembles, probabilistic forecasts, and stochastic forecasts, because I think sometimes I sense that they're being used interchangeably, but aren't they really interchangeable?
Why don't we a answer that by talking
Okay.
about an abstract? I mean, the key is determinism is dead. Long live uncertainty. Chaos reigns, and the night is long.
A poem.
Plunged into darkness, our only hope is to strike out. Actually, Alden, you used a metaphor the other day that was fantastic. You're stuck in a dark room. All you have is a laser pointer. And you're allowed to blast that laser pointer 100 times around the room to try to determine the shape of the room and what's in it. It'd sure be great if you could blast it around 1,000 times. That's sort of, isn't that great? Isn't that a lovely little image of being trapped in a
That's
room with a
amazing.
laser?
That's so funny because I actually also had an Alden quote queued up that I thought was really beautiful from the webinar that you all did yesterday, which, by the way, I really enjoyed it. Honestly,
Oh,
yeah, I
thanks,
thought it was
Marta.
great. Okay, Alden said something along the lines of, they're an honest expression of the fact we can't understand everything about the future, talking about ensemble forecasts.
I love that too. And there's a lot of linguistic choices in these papers that we'll get to about like honesty and fairness and like all these very qualitative abstract words to used to represent like uncertainty. But I like that, Alden. I think maybe to give a high level, we're not talking about one paper in this episode. We're actually going to talk about lots of different recent papers looking at ensemble forecasts using AI in weather. And history repeats itself, sort of, with numerical weather prediction. You had these best-in-class models, and then the next thing they did was, all right, let's ensemblify them. And same as GFS going to GEFS, which we learned was in the early 90s. GraphCast is going to GenCast, and AIFS is going to AIFS Ensemble Edition. So that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about GenCast, AIFS, CRPS, FGN, and how they differ, how they're the same, how they differ from the deterministic, and just get a sense of like where are we headed in terms of ensembles. Is that the be all end all? Is there more? If I were to sum up an abstract, what it seems like is the AI weather forecasts, the first gen or second gen, whatever you want to call them, GraphCast and Pangu Weather, they've set the stage. AI weather forecasts are capable and powerful, but most importantly, extremely efficient. And so you look at that and you're like, oh, it's cheap to run. Let's run it a lot. And so the next obvious leap is these models that can capably represent different kinds of uncertainty. And to perturb those different kinds of uncertainty and run it a gajillion times. And I think what follows is exciting, but still I think a little bit, you know, TBD, to be realized. How can we use massive corpus choirs of ensembles? But I think the stage is set, and that what these papers show is that AI is the perfect tool for it. And when you combine the AI weather models with this approach of ensembling, you get something that the performance is excellent and really exciting.
Nice. That's a great abstract.
All right. See you guys later. If someone has 10 minutes to listen to our podcast, what do they need to know about this latest generation of AI ensembling weather forecasts?
Ensembles are really our way to take a practical approach to make real decisions in the face of all this uncertainty. What do we actually do? And now we've got this increase of efficiency with these AI models, and we can go to increased spatial resolution, which is exciting. We can go to increased temporal resolution, run the model more often, get the information out to you faster. And we can start to explore the range of uncertainty further.
I think, Alden, what you said about like practicality just seems like a really important piece, because I do think on the podcast, our conversations sometimes go off into this theoretical space, like, is chaos the fundamental state of the universe, or could we predict everything, which is a amazingly intellectual and fun conversation to have. But when it comes to like practically forecasting the future, we have to contend with some amount of uncertainty. And I was just really fascinated by the way the two models that we're going to talk about today actually account for uncertainty, both the uncertainty that exists out in the natural world, but also uncertainty with the model itself.
Yeah. And one of the most fun parts when you start, like, my favorite part of these papers was the philosophical aspects of how you take this zoomed out abstract understanding of chaos and uncertainty and then actually decide, okay, this is how we're going to represent that via injecting noise at this stage or perturbing the initial conditions in this way. And that's really fun, because it takes all of this philosophy we've been talking about the limits of predictability and why, and then they're creating mechanics around representing that in the output. And it's super cool. The TLDR is that FGN is really good. Seems to be excellent. If you haven't seen it, DeepMind announced like a hurricane tracker built on FGN. AIFS has been crushing it. So AIFS CRPS also looks sick. So if you are thinking in terms of decisions downstream of weather, those are two models to look at and think about, how do we incorporate these into our modeling processes for sure.
Totally. And we've talked about what new capabilities does AI bring to the weather modeling space. And this is another great example of that. The fact that an AI model learns from an objective lets us state that the objective is to make a forecast that properly matches the uncertainty that we actually experience. And these two papers show a way to actually encode that objective and align our real objective with what we want out of our weather models with the objective that we tell the model to optimize, so we can have the learning process actually get us to the objective that we have about understanding the range of possibilities in the future.
Yeah, you've got the continuous rank probability score. What was it? The fair continuous rank almost probability fair score, the almost fair, and then my favorite, the completely unfair CRPS. That's what I always use, the completely unfair. It always makes me look the best. The Okay, so that's our abstract, I guess. We'll pause there. If you're a high-powered individual with no time to spare, you can log off now. Thanks for listening. Now we're going to talk about books for a second, and then we'll get back into the papers.
Nice.
So, Marta, what are you reading?
Well, are we going to do a weather report? Because mine are connected, as always. Okay.
Always. Absolutely. Go for it. Yeah.
I think we've all actually been traveling a little bit this summer and the past month, but I was going to give the weather report for where I traveled to. Earlier in August, I went backpacking in Montana, and I did two trips, one with pack llamas, which was crazy, and one a little bit more, traditional, where you carry your own stuff.
Who's to say which one of those is the traditional method?
Yeah, because we did co-evolve with animals, and llamas actually predate, is this true? Llamas predate horses in North America. I think that's true. Someone fact check me, but they went down to South America during the Great American Exchange. I think that's what it's called. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. The weather in Montana is crazy. It turns on a dime. We had the full spectrum of super hot days, cold nights, hail, and all of this like sleeping outside. So I felt very weathered during my time in Montana.
Straight out of Lonesome Dove, you know?
Yeah. Very connected to my book recommendation. It's not Lonesome Dove, though that someone should recommend that at some point. I was thinking a lot about this book by Gretel Ehrlich called The Solace of Open Spaces. There's in particular this essay called On Water that I think is one of the best pieces of weather, water writing that exists out in the world. And
wow.
Yeah.
Superlative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thinking of what's downstream of weather. Hydrology. And this essay is super accessible, but I think it's very hydrologically informed and also really gets at this, I'll say too, this whole book is about people in Wyoming, like ranchers, farmers, people that just live super exposed and their life relies on what the weather does and how much water there is. And Gretel Ehrlich totally captures like how when you live that way, you have this inner weather and even the emotionality and the social dynamics of Wyomings are affected by water and weather. It's a really fantastic essay on water by Gretel Ehrlich.
Love it. Do the llamas respond at all to weather or changes in the weather? Because I remember one of my favorite, like, digging into history of weather was animals as weather predictors. So I'm curious, did they foretell?
Yeah, that's like such a rich history of animals predicting weather. I'm working on an essay right now about snakes, and there's so much indigenous knowledge of snakes and weather. But when it started hailing, we were really concerned about the llamas, and we like ran out to where they were staked outside of our tents, and they were totally fine. They had like laid down in their little meadows and were just like eating while laying down. The hail was just pummeling them, completely unbothered by it. Yeah, it was humbling because we were all like, you know, our tent's gonna break, and yeah, our car's dented, I'm sure.
They're just made for this.
Yeah, totally.
I saw you shared some of those pictures of the hail. That was not just like minor hail either. That was pretty intense.
And twice in like a 5-day period, it was really wild weather.
My friend and I keep a list of good names for bands, and I'm going to add minor hail. Alden, what are you reading?
Right now I'm reading The North Wood by Daniel Mason, recommendation from my mother-in-law. And it follows a house over centuries in Western Massachusetts. And the house is really like the central character. And then you get all of the inhabitants and people around it over time. There's a little passage about seasons, particularly about the fall. that stuck with me. It goes, I propose a new calendar, not one autumn, but 12, 100. The autumn when the birches are yellow, but still have their leaves. When the beeches are green, but the birch leaves have fallen. When the oaks tint the color of ripe apricots and the beeches yellow. When the oaks turn a cigar brown and the beeches curl up into crispy copper rolls. And so on. I missed a few, but to call it all just autumn? I think it stuck with me because I'm also in a phase of life where it feels like things are just going fast. Young children and the seasons are starting to change right now. That's maybe my piece of weather report. It got cool all of a sudden around here. And I like that, just paying more attention and realizing that our four seasons is just doesn't cut it.
I love that. I recently found out that in, I think it's Norway or it might be Scandinavia at large, they recognize eight seasons. And it's like summer, fall, fall, winter, like these sort of intermediate seasons that are there to capture the transitional times.
Which are really some of the best times of the year. Those are right on the edge where there's like this anticipation of the next season coming around.
That reminds me, Northwoods is a great book. I enjoyed that one. That kind of season change thing reminds me of not my book, but one of my favorite books that I read with Meadow by Leo Leone. Do you know Leo Leone? Frederick Cornelius. Oh, come on.
Yes.
So good.
Swimmy the fish.
Swimmy. Swimmy's a great one. Mm. This one is Frederick. It's about a mouse who like refuses to work and tells all the other mice that he's like working on things to comfort them in the depths of winter. And once they've run out of food, they're like, Frederick, what have you been doing? Like, come on, show us. And he stands up on a rock and he just begins this poem. Who scatters the snowflakes? Who melts the ice? Who spoils the weather? Who makes it nice? Who grows the four-leaf clovers in June? Who dims the daylight? Who lights the moon? Four little field mice who live in the sky. Four little field mice like you and I. One is the spring mouse who turns on the showers. Then comes the summer who paints in the flowers. The fall mouse is next with walnuts and wheat. And winter is last with little cold feet. Aren't we lucky? The seasons are four. Think of a year with one less or one more. And all the mice are like, oh, Frederick, you're a poet. And he says, oh, I know it. And it ends hard cut to black, credits roll. So good. My recommendation, though, is extremely not a child's book. It is Hyperion and the Fall of Hyperion. It's sci-fi. It's like awesome from the 80s. Excellent foretelling of what's to come. But one of the main devices turns out to be this AI called the Core, the Techno Core. And humans have evolved almost in parallel of the sentience, and they rely on it heavily. The whole plot is based around this premise that the AI can predict everything with extremely high certainty, except there's one planet that has some sort of weird thing going on with time and how time is unfolding. And that is their X factor that prevents the AI from being able to predict anything well. The Hyperion is the planet. And it's a fantastic book. It blows me away that it was written in the 80s because of how it describes artificial intelligence and sentience and a lot of the existential risks that Nick Bostrom went on to write about. You know, it's very like saucy sci-fi. So if you're into that, you'd like it. It was a recommendation from Cody Cooper-Schmidt in our kind of space of AI forecasting. So thank you, Cody. It was excellent. And now I got to read the next two. All right. Let's get back into ensembles, if we may.
I think this is an interesting call back to our limits of predictability. What is that impact on at a theoretical level? Here we are, and this is much more of a practical, well, what can we actually do given that we live in this world with a very chaotic atmosphere? But Marshall, how do we take us back. Let's get started.
Okay, well, with Newtonian physics, first of all, someone we've been working with for a long time, Breen, who's up in Seattle, she corrected me in the webinar because I had my history slightly wrong. So I'm glad to say I've corrected it. So we got Newtonian physics, which ultimately you think about Newtonian equations, right? It's all very deterministic. Like you have a function, it's secure, you know, you plug in the things and you get the output. We have another really important figure, Laplace. I'm going to assume that's a French enough way of saying it. Pierre-Simon de Laplace. So he published this thing on causal determinism where, and it has like a lovely, he refers to this thing, the demon. The demon knows the precise location and momentum of every particle in the universe. Their past and future values for any given time are entailed. They can be calculated from the laws of classic mechanics and Newtonian physics, right? I don't know why it's a demon, but it's like so sinister. The demon can predict anything if it knows the precise location and momentum of every particle in the universe. And I think as we march through the annals of time, we get to really the mid-20th century when there's this resurgence of interest in determinism and forecasting and chaos. In the 1950s, Eric Eady was like, I don't know about this determinism thing. You have Lorenz and his collaborators, Feder and Hamilton, do the seminal limits of predictability paper. This one person, Epstein, started using Monte Carlo methods to study atmospheric predictability and interpreting this blob of points as uncertainty, which is kind of like a proto-ensemble. Lorenz said, hey, that's cool, and created a small ensemble of initial errors to estimate error growth. And then what I found was in the 70s, you have this figure, Leith, I think is how it's pronounced, who suggested that if you take enough forecast runs, you could take the mean of those to get a useful mean forecast. So it's kind of like, you know, there are many other figures that are coming in and out of determinism, uncertainty, ensembles, but in the weather space specifically, that's kind of, those were important moments, I guess, on this journey of, okay, if determinism isn't the thing, what do we do? And I think going back to Lorenz's initial findings where small perturbations in initial conditions result in huge differences, well, it's like, well, okay, let's perturb it. Let's perturb it in a way that represents the uncertainty of the observation. Then you get a bunch of traces. And then perhaps if you take the mean of them, that's the most likely outcome. And then you get a distribution around that.
I also want to add that on, I guess, the other side of the aisle, so to speak, the poets and the artists, while Newton was doing his thing, people were challenging Newton. And I think there was this other sort of aesthetic movement toward non-determinism. You might have seen it, the painting by, he's a poet and a painter, William Blake, who's like a 18th century British icon, depending on who you are. But essentially this painting, and I'll do some like phrases here and describe it for you, but you have this like really jacked Newton who's totally naked, kind of like harkening back to like the Enlightenment era sculptures of various men. But anyway, he's like sitting on a mountain. He might be underwater. His back's to the mountain though, and he's got like a compass in his hands and a bunch of diagrams. And so it's essentially this like metaphor for he's turned his back on the truth of nature to kind of focus on finding these very neat, rational laws for the universe. And nothing enraged William Blake more than Newtonian physics. What I think is really interesting and where this like kind of comes into the conversations about perturbations and how we eventually come to like contend with chaos and uncertainty much later on, William Blake kind of has this like sixth sense for. And so he writes this letter to a friend and he says, "May God keep us from single vision and Newton's sleep." And essentially he's talking about this very like narrow-minded deterministic worldview. And Blake goes on to create kind of a philosophical or spiritual framework that he calls fourfold vision. It's essentially this like multiplicity of consciousness at which he can look at the world. And he thinks that's a more true understanding of the nature that's going on around us.
I love that. I actually have something to build directly on it. And this is something I learned about and then dug it more into from that book, Chaos, that I've referenced a gajillion times. Is it Goethe?
I know.
G-O-E-T-H-E?
Yep.
Goethe?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you got Goethe. I'm talking about Goethe. So Newton looks at color and is like, oh, if I use a prism, it spreads out. And somehow he's like, it must be frequency. And like, red is this frequency. It's a very clinical, very Newtonian way to describe color. And Goethe was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, red is not a constant. Red is perceived. Red is a perception. And so Goethe says, along with the rest of the world, I was convinced that all the colors are contained in the light. No one had ever told me anything different, and I had never found the least cause to doubt it, because I had no further interest in the subject. But how I was astonished as I looked at a white wall through the prism, that it stayed white. That only where it came upon some darkened area, it showed some color. Then at last, around the windowsill, all the colors shone. It didn't take long before I knew there was something significant about color to be brought forth, and I spoke as through an instinct out loud that the Newtonian teachings were false. It's cool because it's related to, he talks about colors and perception, and he does it in a very scientific way, even though it's like very artistic in his kind of interpretation. It's all about boundaries, and boundaries I'm kind of obsessed with right now, about like being related to all of this chaos stuff. Like, at the boundary is where everything happens. And Goethe is like, oh, at the boundary is where the perception of light changes. So anyway, just want to like echo that. And there's another voice of dissent. And they were usually treated as mystics, right? Like, oh, that physicist over there, he's a mystic. Who knows what he's doing, you know? And that was usually the person who's like Goethonian.
Or discovering quantum physics, or coming up later and realize that with many worlds theorem, and that are many universes, and we're actually all, they're really, it's not just four. There's an infinite number of them.
I think siloing all of our natural sciences is one of the most harmful things that we can do for our thinking and our like authentic understanding of the world. And not just siloing natural sciences, but also science from philosophy and literature and all of the other things. And that, I think, is something like the Greeks and Romans really got it right, when you could be like an epic poet and a philosopher king and a mathematician. Those were the days.
Alden, do you want to talk a little bit about GenCast to set the stage of like the one step earlier, the half step earlier?
Yeah, yeah. So these are, of course, not the first two papers within AI weather modeling to work on ensembles. In fact, we talked about Neural GCM. They also did some work with ensembles. People have been emulating the numerical weather prediction world of ensembles and trying to figure out how you might work with that for a few years now with AI weather prediction. I would say in the last year or two years, really, things have really picked up, where these have gone from like research things to, this is a actual recipe that you can follow in order to take this AI weather predictions work we're doing and get ensemble forecasts out of them. Prior to these two papers, DeepMind did paper called GenCast. And this was really built on this work called diffusion modeling. That was how a lot of the image generation AI models work, where they actually like start from complete random noise, and then they refine that noise over a sequence of steps. And at each step, you get less and less noise and more picture actually like comes out of what you're seeing.
There is such a good 3 Blue 1 Brown. Do you know that YouTube channel?
Love it.
They have such a good video on this that we will put in the show notes, because it totally made diffusion make complete sense. Like, oh, and that's why you need the noise. And that's why you need to kind of, it's very similar with this kind of like perturbation, randomness injected into the model. Anyway, sorry, keep going.
Now, these two papers take a pretty different approach. That diffusion process at every single step of the model, you go through this entire inner step of adding a whole bunch of noise and then removing it. And that, so you've got basically like a loop inside your loop of time. And the main downside to that is really just computational efficiency. You've kind of almost doubled the amount of work you might have to do. That's a really general number there. These two papers come along and reframe things and say, let's take a model that is set up quite a bit like our traditional numerical weather prediction models, except it happens to be an AI weather model at the core of it. Instead of getting one number out of it at every point and every time, let's run it multiple times. And then the key here is we can, instead of saying just minimize the error between our prediction, that's a point, and some other prediction, let's reframe that loss function, the objective that we're asking our model to learn, and instead say, please improve the fit, the distribution of all of these ensemble traces that I had predicted relative to the observations that I have. And a commonality between both these papers here is that they use almost exactly the same loss function to do just that.
Almost.
Very close.
So back to my original question, what are ensembles?
We have a huge suite of words to talk about the situation where there are a range of possibilities. You can think about this in like the binary case of something has happened or it didn't happen, and there's just a percent chance that it happened and then another percent chance that it didn't happen. What we're talking about is the chance that the actual value of this quantity takes on a certain number across a wide range. And so when you view that, like if you picture that normal curve in your head, that starts low and then goes up and then goes back down again, that is a drawing of a probability distribution, which is just talking about how likely it is for the value to fall across this range of possible values.
Did you ever play, or I don't know, it wasn't a game, but did you ever in elementary school, they had like the large bowl full of gumballs. And I was like, all right, class, let's guess how many gumballs there are. And everyone wrote down their guess. And then you took the average of the guess and it's right. And everyone's like, that's an ensemble. It's all the individual guesses. And the act of looking at the distribution and mean of those guesses is a way of estimating uncertainty. Now, children in elementary school don't necessarily have the statistical rigor of how they're perturbing their guesses to represent the spread, but physics-based numerical weather predictions do. They will run a forecast model for a range of perturbed initial conditions by introducing stochastic perturbations into the forecast model itself. That's from the AIFS CRPS paper. And for the AI ensembling models, there are a couple different ways that the uncertainty is introduced into the inputs and into the models. But the key is that introduction is in a way that captures the two most important kinds of uncertainty that we'll talk about probably, and that the range of outputs captures the distribution of possible outcomes.
So this ensemble is collection of a whole bunch of different individual independent forecasts that when you look at them all together should make up one ensemble that represents the real probability distribution, the probability that the whatever value you're forecasting actually has comes out to be, you know, 2.5 degrees Celsius.
Okay, it makes sense that the name Ensemble, and I don't know why this was really like stuck in my craw, as they say, but it was,
yes.
I like really needed to understand if Ensemble, that name, like in particular, referred to the output of the multiple forecasts, like it's an ensemble of forecasts. But the FGN paper, they get to those multiple forecasts by perturbing the model itself. So technically it's an ensemble of models and forecasts.
So that is a confusing thing. Yeah, there are ensemble traces. In some cases you have different models that represent like a corpus, a choir, that integrate some of that uncertainty in a way. So maybe I'll just get to it. I read this and I'm like, hell yes, I could just say this over and over again every time I'm meeting with people to sound smart. Although as soon as they realize I don't know what I'm talking about, I'm doomed. All right, you got epistemic and aleatoric uncertainty. All right, Marta? So epistemic is, it's just like such good, those are such good words to like really throw people for a loop, you know?
Definitely.
Aleatoric data uncertainty stems from inherent randomness of variable in a system or process. Epistemic is knowledge uncertainty arising from a lack of knowledge or incomplete information about the system. So what's cool is with the AI models, I think there's a little bit more flexibility in, okay, how do we want to represent epistemic uncertainty? How do we want to represent aleatoric uncertainty? And so I talked about the physics models primarily tackling perturbing initial conditions. But to Alden's note about GenCast, kind of that diffusion process of starting from noise, what they do is they're both doing that and introducing a very constrained way to add noise or randomness into the model itself as error is propagated through the network.
And the key difference with aleatoric uncertainty versus epistemic uncertainty is
that, is it aleatoric?
Oh, this is going to be my Goethe moment. I have no idea. Woe be us that learn by reading. The key thing with that, with aleatoric uncertainty, is that this is representing the actual chaos in the universe, that even if we had more and more and more observations, it's that real randomness that we haven't yet gotten to the bottom of. And that's what we need to represent with ensembles, and why we're probably not going to be able to get back to determinism anytime soon. And then there is the epistemic uncertainty, where this is coming from, you know, our model has only seen so much data about the world. It is a imperfect representation of the system. And so therefore it's going to cause some uncertainty there as well.
Okay. So with this approach of like injecting noise and sort of thinking about both I was thinking about epistemic and aleatoric as sort of this internal and external. I don't think that's really the best way to describe it, but thinking about our two types of uncertainty, could you like theoretically locate the source of inaccuracy of a prediction and trace it back?
That's sort of what the limits of predictability paper did. It tried to point at the initial conditions as being a huge contributor to the error, holding the intrinsic randomness constant. So it's saying, hey, we have an imperfect model, but we are quantitatively decreasing the epistemic uncertainty by back propagating errors to reduce the error of the perceived error of the initial condition. If that is true, then we should see an increase in skill. So I think there are some methods to kind of like play with it, but I don't think you can, it would be very hard to, I think, look at an operational forecast model and just be like, oh, it was bad because today the input error was bad, versus that the model is imperfect. I think separating those two is really hard, but that's why you have an ensemble and you're trying to do both to kind of accurately. And this starts to go to the loss function and why CRPS is so important to this working.
The nice thing about it for these, for practical purposes of making these models, we don't necessarily have to distinguish between the two. And the approaches that are learning to properly calibrate the ensembles and their dispersion that we are making here, they're not able to distinguish them. But on the flip side, they can account for both of them all mixed up together. And in the end, if from a practical perspective, we get a distribution that's well calibrated, which is what we want.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm also thinking too that if it's so like cheap and just, yeah, easy to run the model, then why take it apart when you could run it again with different inputs and then sort of see if like where your issues are that way. Okay, well, before we like go on, I think I still have that question about, is there a difference between ensemble probabilistic forecast and stochastic forecasts?
Stochasticity is a meaning noise or randomness. And so that is one way to think about it, is that's one of the approaches that we can use to get to an ensemble forecast that represents our probability and uncertainty about the future. And that's ensemble. Another way to think about it is that ensemble forecasts are a recognition that there is stochasticity, randomness in the atmosphere that we must account for.
Yeah, ideally, it would just be like, oh, we know that our observations have this limited precision, and you just step across that range of precision. But I think randomness is an inherent like means to an end.
That's actually kind of a great segue into the loss function that these models use. Looking at the uncertainty in the observations of the, particularly observations of the initial conditions of the atmosphere, and then estimating that, and then using that range of uncertainty to create a bunch of very similar but slightly different perturbed initial conditions, that is at the core of the way numerical weather models have been doing uncertainty, creating these ensembles for years. The catch is that you do that, and then you might have represented the uncertainty in your initial observations pretty well, but you do that and then you run it through, and the ensembles you get out may or may not be well calibrated to the range of real possibilities that you see out in the world. Maybe that's because there's some epistemic uncertainty that is coming from your model that you didn't account for, and you end up being too confident in your dispersion of the ultimate traces that you get out. So what a commonality between these two papers, they flip it around and they say, so for every single neural network, we need to have some objective, some loss function that is a value that we want to improve. And in this case, they've changed that from being just the difference in, you know, between my prediction and what the observation was. And instead they've said, we want to make this the difference between the probability distribution that we predicted and the true probability distribution of this quantity that we're trying to forecast. And in doing so, they have entirely aligned the objectives of the machine learning algorithm with our objectives as humans, which is that we want our forecast to really actually represent the real range of possibilities that might happen.
To Alden's point around earlier he made around GenCast's like inefficiency, FGN can run much more quickly, which allows it to produce, you know, if you want 1,000 ensemble members, you could do that. And it's just gonna take a little bit of compute, but not an completely unreasonable amount of compute. Both of these papers, and even in their abstracts up front, really say like, the limit is just how much you want to run it in terms of how many ensemble members you want. So I think I haven't wrapped my head around the scenario where you really want to scale that infinitely, but it's almost like, you know, image enhancement, right? Like the resolution of uncertainty should theoretically improve the more ensemble members you have. It, because of this approach to training and the loss function. So if you run it with 5 ensemble members, you're kind of squinting at the uncertainty. If you run 100, you have a better resolved picture of uncertainty. If you run it with 1,000, you're going to get an even better picture. So I think that's why it's interesting and useful. And if you look at the current state of the prior art, you know, with GEFS and IFS's ensemble forecast, I think those are mega chunk, like supercomputers running for hours, and that limits the frequency that they could be issued, the number of ensemble members they can have. GEFS has what, 30 something?
Yeah, 31.
I think everyone with weather is always focused on spatial resolution, but this is kind of like a new kind of resolution, a resolution on uncertainty that I think this is able to cast light on, which is cool.
That also is a real trade-off. So, you know, GEFS is not able to run at as high of a spatial resolution, and ECMWF's ensemble just started working at maybe a year ago at the same resolution as their high resolution model.
Back to your point quickly about like running the models infinitely and kind of each additional run ideally gives you a sharper and closer understanding. Is there at some point where that each additional run like does have diminishing returns or?
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course.
But we haven't found that necessarily.
I'm sure you get a good enough shape of uncertainty at a certain point. But all of this, close your eyes without looking. What do you think the ground truth is? Okay, you can open your eyes. What's your answer? It's ERA5, right? Like a lot of this is, I think, still skirting around the problem of doing the miserably hard work of making a good end-to-end forecast. Like, how far will we take it until we just pony up and get the end-to-end forecast going? Because if that is ground truth, the uncertainty of ERA 5, you can only represent the uncertainty so far.
Like that, it's all gone through a model, so it's going to have more structure to it, ERA5 data that you're treating as ground truth, than the real world, the real messiness of true observations way out there in the world.
Yeah, at which point there needs to be a completely heterogeneous approach of the uncertainty of different stations, different methods, like God help us all. But that's the approach that I think is really like the next step. Okay, we've done, and again, maybe like history repeats itself. You have your global forecast model. Then you're like, ah, crap, this isn't good enough. Let's do the ensembles. And then you're like, ah, crap, we got to assimilate a ton of observations. And like, that's exactly what happened. And that's what's going to happen here. It's just you're stepping through complexity and hardness. And it's, I think, especially with the end-to-end model, there are some great examples out there. We covered Aardvark and there are other ones, but it stops being like a neat problem, like a paper, research paper problem. And it starts to become a massive scale, operational tech, data messiness, real time, whatever problem. And that's a whole different class of crap.
Yeah. Marta, I want to come back to that question you had about at what point is enough in terms of ensemble members and all that. I think what we have heard just in our work and talking with people, not all ensemble members are created equal. People are really interested in the extremes. And as I was reading both these papers, I was thinking about, could you go variable with the density of your ensemble members? And for example, over sample, get more information at the widest tail ends of the distribution. And just understand, here are my initial 100 ensemble members. They're evenly spread across the whole thing. But now for the most extreme top 10 and the bottom 10, I want to like get even more all right around that. I think what's cool about for both of these approaches is there's plausible ways where you could do that. And it's sort of like an iterative process. You run it one time and then you keep an idea of what noise you added in and which of those noises created the most extreme versions, and then could come back and like further resolve the most interesting tales of the extreme. I think people would be really, really interested in that. People really want to know what's going on those edges of the distribution.
So moving from so right now you almost have a tree with one root and no nodes.
Yeah.
Right. And what you're talking about is moving to a tree, an ensemble tree, TM. I'm trademarking that, everyone. That's almost certainly a thing. But you, like each on at key junctions, the ensemble branches and kind of explodes. And that actually represents reality well, where the further out you get, the more, I guess, both aleatoric and epistemic uncertainty there is. So it's like you start with 5 and those 5 branch to 25 and those 25 branch, you know, and by the end you have like this really broad, and that's how, when you're not using traces to represent uncertainty, that's sort of how it works. You expect uncertainty to branch out, and the ensemble traces, even when it's a one node tree, they branch out and get more distant. But that kind of like way to walk down the paths of reality is kind of, it feels like interactive and cool.
Yeah. And it, you know, so to actually kind of describe the different ways that these models inject noise into the process, it's probably the most obvious way to do that was with what AIFS CRPS does, where at every single time step, every single location, they pick a random number from a distribution, and then they transform that number a little bit and turn it into something that they can then add into the state at that location. So you could imagine, instead of just picking one random number for every single location, whenever it's time to branch, you pick 2 numbers or 3 numbers, and then you now have, from the state that you were at, you now have 3 branches coming out of it there. The FGN paper, on the other hand, they get their randomness first. They're actually training, in this case, 4 different models. So they start those models with slightly different random seeds. The models see the data that they're training on in a little bit different order. So all this, by random seeds, I mean the strength of the connections are a little bit different to start out with. And then they see data in a little bit different order. They're ultimately training from the same data sets, but that variation in the initial strength of the connections and how they see the data means that you get 4 different models that are fully trained, but just a little bit different. And then they go, and this is the part that was really interesting to me, instead of adding noise at every single time step and every single location independently, they add noise not to the states of the atmosphere, but to the model weights themselves. So they're making small changes to the model versus changes to the state of the atmosphere. And what they report is that this is very good at ensuring that the things happening nearby are realistic. So we didn't just, you know, randomly increase something, some quantity at one grid cell, but then one over, it's got randomly increased down in a way that like might not actually be realistic. Instead, we've got this like physically realistic model, and then we make small tweaks to it, but it's one unified model. So the rules of physics that it's evolving over time are consistent across the entire model.
Was that AIFS or FGN?
FGN, what I was describing was FGN, whereas AIFS is injecting noise that's totally independent at the different locations and time steps.
Yeah. Yeah. They give it 32 degrees of like random freedom. And that those 32 degrees are like, you could think about them as like knobs that affect large swaths of the output, where it doesn't allow it to just get too specific with the randomness. And I think that I agree that that part was really cool. It's so limited with only 32 knobs that the way for the model to succeed, given the loss function, is to capture the natural correlations across space and time.
Basically.
So that's one of the ways they differ. Are there any other major ways? Because otherwise the papers, I read them a couple days apart, but they seemed pretty similar otherwise. I have to give the ECMWF team that worked on this 10 points for their scorecards and visuals. Very inspirational. I love it. Good job. You could digest them at a glance. I thought it was really nice work. Definitely check, if you're into that kind of thing, check out the figures. Figure 7, figure 6, super hot.
Yeah. And it wasn't just you that appreciated those. I don't think I've seen a more widely social media shared scorecard than
definitely social media-able.
Than when the ECMWF went operational with this, which is another 10 points. If I went back and looked at the timestamps on these, the paper hit archive on December 20th, 2024. And then ECMWF was running this with operational support, as in like 24/7, we will fix issues if there are any problems. Like, this is a backed product by the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting.
Yeah,
6 months later, July of 2025. And it's like,
I gave 10 points. I'm sorry. I gave 10 points. I'm going to deduct 10 points because it looks really good. And I love it. And still inspired. Great work, everyone. But there's no legend for the colors. It's described in text. I don't know if that's like a requirement of the paper or something, but like, what does dark green mean? I have to like read this text description. Anyway, that is not as bad as the FGN paper, who chose, I don't even know, blue and dark blue as the two colors for GenCast and FGN to compare them. I'm looking at figure 3. Like, come on. Are you kidding me? Those are the same colors. And ground truth is like almost a solid line, but supposed to be a dotted line. I don't know if it's just the HTML version I'm looking at, but like, I cannot tell what is going on.
Blue and black, but yeah, those are similar colors.
Okay, I'm sorry. There are better ways to contrast two things you're comparing.
Yeah.
Well, if we're giving points, which I'm not sure I like this trend, but I really appreciate how the FGN paper did not do that thing, which is becoming kind of popular, where the paper itself is almost a blog post of just like quick hit handpicked results, like case studies. And then you got to go to the like scroll, go all the way past the references to the appendix, where like all the good stuff is in the appendix, but it's mixed in with all the appendix stuff that really should be an appendix. And I thought, I really appreciate how the FGN paper like kind of just jumped right into the methods and explained them without a whole bunch of flowery language, just getting into like, this is how it's different and this is why it works. Like
I loved the FGN's REV, relative economic value. Yes, C and L ratios, where C is the cost of preparing, L is the loss incurred when encountering the event. I wanted to read like a whole paper on that, and they reference one, so I will. But I thought that was a really cool method. And honestly, like maybe an interesting loss function kind of like concept of like, you want your ensemble members to maybe make sure that they capture really high REV events. So like, you want to make sure that, like, we all talk about the extremes and like, yes, you want, it's, you know, all of this forecasting stuff comes down to the end user and what decisions are they trying to make and what things do they need to avoid. But if you have a specific agency that's like tasked with making the call on evacuation right now, it's a very human process to like make that judgment call, look at the traces, understand when do you get to a critical amount of certainty around the uncertainty to like issue the evacuation. And I wonder if we could, and I'm sure many folks do this that I'm not aware of, but you know, using this concept of REV to almost reward the model to have traces that maybe err a little bit more towards representing that, or like have a specific corpus of traces that are specifically trying to minimize loss. Can you use those and like visualize those in blue next to the normal ones that are black, and then you squint and try to determine which ones are blue and which ones are black? I'm just kidding. But that would be really interesting. Like when we're talking about ensembles, having ensembles that don't just spread trying to capture uncertainty, but like ensembles that have different purposes.
Yeah. I think this is a great push of relating the actual statistical metrics that people tend to use, and going a step further to metrics that are quantifying something about real world impact. And what's those are usually the details are the catch there, or like that's actually pretty hard to do, to make a little equation that or some sort of process to calculate that. But what's cool that they did that here is that it opens the possibility now to actually fine tune your models to those objectives, which some could call, you know, trying to juice that. But in reality, if that's what matters in the world, like that, then we can say a model, please get as good at making it as this real world objective as we really, as you possibly can.
Yeah, I just like the UX of like certain ensemble traces carrying a certain meaning. I think that's like an interesting feature that isn't present in weather forecasts that at least I'm consuming right now. All of this has been really fun because especially we're doing a big push on seasonal modeling and annual hydrology modeling. So all of these, it's like we're kids in a candy shop looking at all of these new toys that we can use to make our downstream forecasts better. Is it the same as just incorporating GEFS because they're kind of following that paradigm?
Yes and no. Well, the first part to go back to assume we have access, not always so. And that's actually one reason why I think both of these papers are notable. AIFS CRPS, it's called AIFS ENS out in the world when you get it from ECMWF, but that is accessible and operationally produced right now. Similarly, FGN is not the one that's publicly available. They're the GenCast-based Weather Next Gen is what's publicly available from Google at the moment, but it's clear that FGN is being produced behind the scenes and probably available very soon. And that's not the case for many research projects where there will be a cool paper, maybe even be open source weights and code, but the actual somebody running it and making sure it shows up every single day is definitely something that as a user is really critical to get it from like, this is interesting to talk about to this is actually going to have an impact on our work. This like blossoming of ensembles is really cool for us as forecast users. Now I'm talking from my upstream tech hydro forecast water modeling side of thing hat. We now don't have like, say, two ensembles to use. We've got like an ensemble of ensembles, and that comes with some new user experience questions about how do you surface these to users to actually help them understand what's going into it, and who wants to see a combined forecast that takes everything all together, and who really wants to like dig into the details into individual forecasts. But overall, it's really exciting because we're getting more diversity, and that should lead us to a better combined ensemble when we take fundamentally different modeling processes, all working to make ensemble forecasts coming at that from different directions. We're much more likely to get a better representation of the full range of possibilities in the weather. So as a user, it's a very exciting times.
Any other closing thoughts?
I have maybe like one last question or just something that I'm kind of thinking about. And I feel like the answer is either really easy or more convoluted, but I guess I'm just like, is there a situation in which a deterministic model is better to use? Because I think just like from kind of a common sense place or just an intuitive place, my question is like, why would you run that? Yeah.
I would say, practically speaking, at some point, somebody needs to make a decision. And in many cases, our decision-making frameworks are not probabilistic or risk-aware. That can be tricky to make. So at some point, in many cases, a human really just needs a number. In the face of all this chaos and uncertainty in the atmosphere, one thing has generally proven true, that taking the average, if you are in that situation, taking the average of your entire, all of your ensemble members is almost always going to get you a better answer than if you had not gone through that ensembling process and just tried to make a deterministic prediction from the start.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess I'm thinking too, like, I've been so conditioned by like the Hydra forecast interface and just like our Hydra graph and the fact that there's a mean there. So I'm like, you have that average, but that's not necessarily like the output of all of these models, like this super operational and clear output of data. So yeah, I guess I understand the need to make a decision and still come back to, why not use the mean of your ensembles?
What do you think, Marshall?
I'm super excited about these papers, and the method seems like a excellent way to capture this chaos and uncertainty we've been talking about for all the episodes of this podcast. It feels inelegant, and it feels like you're brute forcing around something. And so I still feel wanting more, wanting some, you know, and maybe this is the delusion of determinism, but I'm hoping that there's something more elegant around representing uncertainty and using these models to output a probabilistic forecast that doesn't require a brute force method, even though these are like super exciting. And we're obviously going to immediately use these in our other work. It just feels inefficient.
If you look at what came before each of these papers and how long it took to come out with this paper, I'm optimistic that this is not the final word. There'll be continued pushes that take us even further than this, admittedly, brute force method of quantifying the chaos in our future.
ERA 6 will be the final word.
It's coming.
The ground truth.